Okay, over the next few weeks, we'll be addressing many technologies of the 20th century associated with the beginning of life. We'll be looking at topics such as artificial insemination, which we'll be focusing on tonight and next week. We'll look at IVF, gender assignment these days, things which were unimaginable a few just a few decades ago, so people could actually choose the gender of their child, surrogacy, and many more topics. And these topics raise many moral, legal, and of course, halachic questions and concerns. Legal concerns are huge. Who's the father of the child? Does the donor have to give parental support? It's just endless amount of questions legally. Morally, of course, there's many questions. And halachically, there's even more questions, as usual. As you've said many times before, sounds like very cliched. I've said it a number of times. We're dealing with these topics since there exists such a broad range of opinions, in addition to the magnitude of the implication of the topic itself. We're talking about a real life topic which many people face. It's important to remember that our goal here is not to make any halakhic rulings, God forbid, we're not doing that, but we're here to study the matter, to study the subject at hand from the various halakhic sources, and thereby gain an understanding of Judaism's view on these complex issues. We'll begin our discussion with the topic of artificial insemination. Now, why are we starting with this particular topic? Why not choose IVF or one of the others? Both because the possibility of artificial insemination has been around for a lot longer than the other technologies. It's very old. We'll say soon exactly where it all started, and what are the very early sources for it. And which obviously means, because it's been around longer, there's much more halachic literature on it, which is important for us. Halachic literature, we'll see, which dates back to the Talmud. The Talmud already discusses the topic of artificial insemination, whereas you're not going to find in any halachic writings up till very quite recently the topic of IVF mentioned. Of course, if you have, the further back that you have these halachic writings, halachic literature, the more we have to deal with. Because as the way that we work in Judaism is that the earlier the generations were, the more credible they are and the more trustworthy kind of they are. And therefore, we'll have sometimes based on one line of the Talmud, we'll build many, many different kind of laws, many halachas. Whereas today, the way it is that every rabbi has his own opinion, and that may be a later opinion and not something as credible as those which were in earlier generations. Also, we'll look at this topic first, because by understanding the halachic standpoint on artificial insemination, it will make it a lot easier to understand IVF, surrogacy, gender assignment, all these other topics for which the sources are quite similar. You'll see that the sources, a lot of them are based on artificial insemination, and from there we draw out. Of course, there's many other different issues which arise with those topics, but we'll get to them as we come to them. Now, what is artificial insemination? Artificial insemination is simply the process of depositing semen of a man into a woman without any physical union. That's what artificial insemination is. There are three types of artificial insemination. There is, which all depend on the source of the semen, where it came from. There is artificial insemination using the sperm, the semen of the husband, known as AIH, artificial insemination husband. Then there's artificial insemination using the semen which comes from a donor. Sometimes the donor could be a known donor, a specific donor. Sometimes the donor would be someone who is unknown, comes from a bank. That would be called AID, artificial insemination donor. And sometimes the third possibility, third way that it works, would be a mixture of the semen of the husband and the donor, which is medically called AIHD, artificial insemination husband donor. Why would someone use that? Just see people wondering why would that be used? The main reason it would be used is just to give the husband psychological feeling that perhaps, you know, the child is from him and is his own. But that is quite rare. It's not always used. It's usually one of those two, AIH from the husband, or AID, artificial insemination, from the donor. Process of fertilization in the woman then continues in a most natural manner, just like would be in any other pregnancy. Now, artificial insemination can obviously only be successful if there's no physiological problem with the woman, right? If there's a physiological problem with the woman, then other ways, other sources, other things would have to be tried. And close to, now why is it used? Because in close to 50% of couples who have problem with fertility, in close to 50% the problem is from the male. It's male infertility. And in many cases, that can be solved. Not all cases, of course not. But in many cases, it can be solved by artificial insemination. And that's when it would be employed. That's when it would be used. Another reason, so that's the main source. That's the main reason why it would be used. Another reason for artificial insemination is sometimes, this is something which is coming about more modern today, if the husband is going to, God forbid, has a malignancy or something, he's going to undergo some chemotherapy, some radiation therapy, whatever it may be, which may cause him to go sterile. What he would want to do is to harvest his semen in some way that it could be used at a later stage to inseminate his wife so that he could have children at a later stage. So too, a husband, a man who is having nervous problems. I'm saying nervous problems with his spinal cord, where it takes time, but over a few months, he would also become sterile. So there too, perhaps the husband would want to have some of his semen taken from him, so that at a later stage it could be used that he could have more children. Another possibility, a rare possibility, but coming much more common these days, is of a single woman who wasn't able to marry, wants to have children. She go to the doctor, go to the donor bank, and be able to have children with no husband whatsoever. So those are the situations of how it happens. Artificial insemination is not something new, something which has been around for a while. By the year 1700, it was already being carried out in animals. It was usually used to increase the usefulness of the best male animals. You have a very strong bull, a very strong ox. You know, they wanted to have the farmer wanted to have many oxen. He wanted to have many prize bulls. What would he do? He used that one prize bull to inseminate many others. That was already done 1700s. The first time it was successfully done on a human being was in London in 1790. It's all just the scientific knowledge about it. So it's something which has been around for a long time, but really only started to be a real successful option in America in 1866. That's when it started. So it's far back. We're talking, 140 years already that it's been used as a successful option. Now we'll look at fascinating sources from the Talmud and the Medrash. We'll look at them tonight. I have copies of them in English. Dating back 2,000 years. From the Talmud, from the Medrash. Remember, the Medrash is it's not the halachic part of Talmud, halachic part of rabbinic literature. It's more the agadic part, which is more story-like and things like that, as you'll see in this literature. So usually, something which comes from the Talmud is used definitely in halacha, in putting together Jewish law. Something which comes from the Medrash, which is more story-like, will not be used for definitive halachic rulings. We'll see. But anyway, this fact needs particular emphasis, as has been noted in many medical journals, in many rabbinic journals, in many places, that this is in fact the earliest source in human history which speaks about this possibility of insemination without a physical union between husband and wife. And this is actually, I looked it up because I wanted to see. In the Middle Ages, they discussed the possibility, but never of it being as something which could. I mean, they spoke about could it be something like that, but wasn't something which seemed to be real to them. In Islamic literature, they have it from the 1300s. So this is 1300 years after the Talmud. There, they first bring up the idea. They said that there was a certain man who wanted an imam, or someone who wanted to affect his enemy. So what he did is that somehow he took the seed of a wild, crazy man and impregnated that man's wife. It's some crazy story. But remember, that is 700 years ago. The Talmud, which we're going to look at, preceded that by many hundreds of years. We'll see it's a fascinating source. Before we get to the sources, which we'll look at and be referring back to, Let's mention some of the questions, the issues which artificial insemination raises. What are some of the issues which we have to look at? And by doing so, it will be a lot easier for us to navigate our way through this complex issue. So let's break it down. Let's look at the different issues. So first of all, anyone here have an issue, have a topic, have a question which comes to mind on the topic of artificial insemination? Yeah. Okay, that wasn't a question which I had down, but let's first look at the source and you see, because the truth is, the Talmud is ultimate knowledge. They didn't have things, but they knew, they may not have had the technologies and things, but they knew that certain things are possible. They understood that it's possible, and as we've seen in these different classes, how a lot of these things are mentioned, about are dated back to the Talmud and the Midrash. Let's look at the source. But more on the halachic, the complexities. I'll mention a few, but I'm giving it to you first to bring them up.
You spoke about people being able to, for example, I know they're going to have chemotherapy, or they know they're going to expunge. What about people who are going to war?
Excellent question.
They know they're going to war, but that means there's a much higher chance they might not survive, and they haven't yet had children.
And he wants to have children. Very good question. What about... This is a question which is posed. I was actually going to talk about this at the end of tonight. The question which is posed to rabbis in this century, talking about rabbis who are still alive, the big rabbinic disciples of the day. Question was, a man died. And can the doctors say that they're able to take out his semen from him? Can they take it out and impregnate his wife right now? They ask halachically, and we'll see that there are halachic implications. He answered, you'll see, we'll bring out what he said. How he said that it's something which is not done. But there are halachic implications to that as well. An example of halachic implications would be, for example, there's a mitzvah called yibum. What is yibum? Means, and it still applies till today, if a man was married to a woman and he died without having children, the halacha is, till today, that what would be, in the times of the temple, he would actually have to marry she would have to marry her husband's brother, which is called Levirate marriage. Today, no one marries, but there's a process which has to be done by an expert Beth Din, which is called the process of Chalitza. Chalitza is a process where she takes off his shoe, and there's a whole process by which a woman who didn't have children should get out of that marriage to her dead husband's brother. Right? So the question is like this. Let's say that a guy died, didn't have children, but they can somehow get some of his semen, right, to impregnate his wife, right? Do we say then that the Levirate marriage has taken effect and she still has to marry the brother? Or, well, she had the whole point was that she didn't have children, but now she can have children. We'll discuss that later on. That's a fascinating question which comes to mind. The other issues are, obviously, is artificial insemination permitted at all? Is it permitted? And why would it be permitted? Why would it not be permitted? Is it possible to use the semen of a donor, which is of course different to using that of the husband, the second kind, the AID? Is there a difference if the husband is a Jew or a Gentile? We'll see. If the donor is a Jew or a non-Jew, we'll see that it does make a difference. In this case, in fact, it would be better, as we'll understand, to use from a non-Jew than to use from a Jew. We'll understand why. Does the donor or the husband fulfill the mitzvah of pru urvu, the mitzvah of procreation? There's a mitzvah, the first, very first mitzvah of the Torah, the very first commandment of the Torah is to have children. So what does the Torah want you to do? Does the Torah want you to just have that children should come about through you? Or does the Torah require that there actually be a physical union to bring about the child? What exactly? All these questions, what they actually do is that they make us think deeper. They make us think deeper to what the Torah actually wants from us. Does it just want the outcome, the children? Well, artificial insemination brings children. Or does it want that it should come about in a natural way with a union of husband and wife? Is the offspring, another question, is the offspring, well, a man's children born through artificial insemination considered to be his children? Are they considered to be the children of either the husband or the donor, whatever it was, in all respects? What do you mean by that? For inheritance purposes? For Levirate marriage purposes, as we mentioned. And such a child who is born in such a way, who curses the parent, who curses his father, sorry, or hits his father. Now the Torah says that a child who hits or curses his father, in the days when there was capital punishment was carried out, such a child would, if there was warning, and the child did it knowingly, and the child was already grown up, there would actually, there could be capital punishment, there could be a death penalty. Would a child born in such a way be really the son of that father to a degree that he'd actually get the death penalty, or not? We'll see why. It raises many fascinating questions. Another major issue is that there's a major biblical prohibition of emitting semen for nothing. That's a major issue. And that is why in Judaism, the condom is not allowed. Unless it's certain extreme situations with consultation of great rabbis, so it would only then it would be permitted. Now the question over here is, can the husband give his semen for such a purpose? Do we say, well, that is for nothing, because it's not the natural way of doing things? Or perhaps we say, well, this is part of the process of them trying to have children. Well, obviously, then it is allowed. Also, if he's allowed to do it, which we'll see that obviously it is allowed, according to most and the accepted opinion today, how should it be obtained? What's the best way of getting it from the husband? Obviously, there are ways in which it should be done, ways which it should not be done. Another question regarding artificial insemination from a donor, which that one we'll really touch on next week, but that is really a major topic. The rule is, halacha says, the Torah says, a woman who's married and lives with another man, right, she's not allowed to return to her husband. Even if the husband, for whatever reason, allowed it. It doesn't make a difference. God doesn't allow it. Hashem doesn't allow it. And he says that such a woman, that adulterous woman, is not allowed to return to her husband. Okay? Now, would a woman who got inseminated from someone else, from a donor, be permitted to continue living with her husband or not? Basically, what does the Torah... Again, we're going back to... Now we really have to think deeply. That's the next one. Is it considered, let's first talk about the adultery itself, of continuing living with her husband. Is it considered an act of adultery, right? Or is the prohibition of adultery only if there is a physical union between them, right? So again, what does the Torah have an issue with? When the Torah says that a woman who has an affair, is not allowed, an affair could be even if the husband wants it and doesn't care, is not allowed to return to her husband. Is it because she did something? She got something from someone else while she's married. She had something to do with someone else, with another husband, something intimate to do with someone else while she's married, or is it only because there was a physical union? That's the question. And the practical implication is this case is artificial insemination, where she got inseminated from a donor. Can she continue living with her husband? And your question is even a bigger question. What's the status of the child born through artificial insemination from a donor? Obviously, the husband is not the issue. Here we're talking about the idea of the donor. The Torah says there's something called the mamzer. Mamzer we translate as a bastard. But what is a mamzer? Not any child who's born from a forbidden union is a mamzer whatsoever. There's very, very few who are actually classified as a mamzer. A mamzer is a child who's born from a mother who had relations, well, we don't know whether it's had relations, who's born when the mother is already married to someone else, and that child is a child of another man. That's what a mamzer is. Not from anything else. Someone who had children out of marriage, God forbid, is not called a mamzer at all. And all these things are not called a mamzer. A mamzer is a very, very rare situation. Well, rare situation, there's only very few of them in the Torah, where husband and wife are married, and the wife has children from somewhere else. So over here, we ask ourselves a question like this. She has a child from someone else, meaning the semen came from somewhere else. It came from another man. But really, what is the prohibition, what causes the mamzer? That's what we have to ask ourselves. When the Torah said that if a woman has a child from another man, when she's already married to someone else, the child is a mamzer, Does the Torah call the child a mamzer because there was a forbidden union between the two people, where in the case of artificial insemination, there was no such thing? Or perhaps the Torah just doesn't want that there should be a child born to a woman from another man, doesn't matter how the child was born, where she's already married to Mr. A. That's the question, a very major question. These are just some of the halachic, and legal questions at hand. Of course, legal questions, many more questions. I was just looking up today, just looking at the encyclopedia, just a medical encyclopedia, just to try and get a bit of knowledge on the topic. I talk about questions such as, if a husband forces his wife to go through it, to be artificially inseminated, is it considered to be rape or not? I mean, kind of questions like this, is a legal question, or is it actually the forcing to have children, or is it the forcing, you know, it's all these kind of questions. As you can see, what these questions do is that they make us think a little bit deeper. That's why people wonder, they say, look, the Talmud is such a big set of books. Talmud takes up a whole shelf, right? And then you've got Maimonides takes up a whole shelf. So what, you go to Israel, you go to America, you go to even to Gold, and you just see new books being printed every single day. What are they writing in these books already? What's there to write more? Everything's been written, hasn't it? And the truth is, it hasn't. Because as these new technologies come about, we are compelled to look deeper and try understand deeper the meaning of the Torah. When the Torah tells us that a child who's born to a married woman who had an affair with someone else is a mamzer, so we ask ourselves the question, well, what does the Torah not like over here? Does the Torah not like the physical union? Does the Torah not like that a child is being born? When the Torah says that there's a mitzvah to have children, right, what does the Torah want? Does the Torah want you to have children with a physical union? Or does the Torah just want that there should be people settled on the earth, doesn't matter how they came about to be? We have to ask ourselves these kind of questions. Let's look at some of the sources upon which these discussions are based. We'll gain a bit of an understanding over here.
That's
a whole discussion itself. It's a not actually.
So
no.
That's
where
it comes
in. We'll see down as Jewish or not Jewish makes a very big difference. We'll see how there's a major, major difference.
So if a child is born through artificial insemination through a donor, then the child is not a mamzer?
What?
If a child
that's what we're going to discuss. That's exactly what we're raising the issues. I just want to whet your appetite. I want to whet your appetite, okay? But we'll see exactly. You say it definitely can't be. We'll see. As I said, there's an argument within this. It's a fascinating topic, and the most amazing thing is that there's very early sources that you look at. First source, we're going to look at the three sources. And we're going to be getting back to them, so have them in mind. First source is the Talmud itself. The Talmud says like this. Ben Zoma was asked. Ben Zoma was actually not of the time of the Talmud. He even was before the Talmud. Ben Zoma was from the Mishnaic period. But the Talmud quotes what he was asked. Ben Zoma is in fact one we mentioned in the Haggadah on Pesach, because he was one of those who spoke in the Haggadah, and therefore we mentioned him there. Ben Zoma was asked, may a high priest marry a maiden who has become pregnant yet who claims she's still a virgin? Now, just the background knowledge. Background knowledge is that a simple Kohen, is not allowed to marry a divorcee. Okay? He can marry a widow, no problem. He's not allowed to marry a divorcee. A Kohen Gadol, a high priest, says in the Torah, he has to marry a virgin. That's it. Torah says black and white. Besula me'amav yikach isha, a virgin of his nation he shall take as a wife. Okay? She has to be a virgin. She can be old, doesn't matter what, but she has to be a virgin. Now, Ben Zoma was asked, may a high priest marry a maiden who has become pregnant, yet she claims she's still a virgin? Okay? Sounds familiar from other religions, but he replied, look what he answered. He says, we do consider the possibility. He says, it's not what she's saying is not totally far-fetched. Because he says, we consider the possibility that she may have conceived in a bath into which a male has discharged semen. That's exactly his answer. So he says, you know what? If we can somehow find out that she's a virgin, right? It doesn't matter that she got pregnant. Maybe she got pregnant that she went to a bath where a male had been there, and for whatever reason discharged semen in the bath, and she got pregnant straight from that. Okay? And that is the Talmud. Okay? So the Talmud says we consider the possibility, we consider it to be actually possible for such a thing to come about. The second source is the Medrash. The Medrash says like this, and we'll discuss it and explain it. Ben Sira, we'll explain who Ben Sira was. Ben Sira was a certain man. These are the words of the Medrash itself. Ben Sira was conceived without sexual intercourse by the prophet Jeremiah's daughter in a bath, the father being Jeremiah himself, who was forced by wicked men to emit semen into the water. Now, from that itself, you see the difference between Talmud and Medrash, right? Talmud is very halachic. Ben Zoma was asked a halachic question, you know? The high priest wants to get married. Problem is that the person who wants to marry is pregnant. He's not allowed to marry a virgin. Do we say that for sure she definitely can't be a virgin when she's pregnant? Or do we say, well, you know, it's possible that she got pregnant in a bath? And Ben Zoma says, yes, it's possible that she could have got pregnant and not broken her and not lost her virginity. The Medrash talks about something a little bit, which is a little bit, not as halachic, more story-like. It tells background to a story. And says like this, Ben Sira, who was the certain man, he was conceived. His father was also his grandfather, right? But not that there was any sexual union between his mother and his father at all, who was also his grandfather, Jeremiah the prophet Jeremiah. An incredible story. Now, some rabbis write, and this is a story known as, in Talmudic literature, the legend of Ben Sira. Okay? Ben Sira, no one less than the son of Yirmiyahu, than the prophet Yirmiyahu, who wrote Eicha, and he wrote Yirmiyahu, and one of the greatest prophets who ever lived. He says that Ben Sira himself says the Medrash was born, came about through some kind of artificial insemination. We'll see soon there is a difference between these cases, where it actually was in a bathhouse, and where it's actively done the way it's done today. There could be a bit of a difference, as we'll see. Now, some rabbis write that because he was born, look at this interesting one, because he was born of a gathering of seed without any physical union, therefore his name was originally Ben Zerah. The Hebrew word for seed is Zerah. Okay? But because later on he was a little bit embarrassed to walk around with the name Ben Zerah, the son of seed, right? So he changed his name. He changed his name to Ben Sira, the son of Sira. Why the name Ben Sira? Sira is written Samach Yud Resh Aleph. The numerical value of the word Sira is Yirmiyahu. Right? So for those who don't know, in Hebrew, every single letter has a value. Aleph is worth 1, Beis is worth 2. There's something called Gematria. Gematria means that there's numerical value to certain words, and if certain words have the same numerical value, it means that there's some kind of connection between them. It's a whole topic on its own, the idea of Gematria, where it comes from. But he changed his name from Ben Zerah, son of seed. He wanted to show that, no, don't make fun of me, I'm the son of seed. I'm son of no one less than Yirmiyahu, the great prophet, right? So he called himself the son Ben Sira, because Sira, Samach, Yud, Reish, Aleph, is the same numerical value as Yirmiyahu. I think it's 271. If you count it up, the exact same. Yirmiyahu, Sira is the same value to show that he was his son. Of course, there are rabbis who don't use this source, don't rely on the source for definitive legal adjudications, for halachic rulings, because it is midrashic. It's agada, it's a piece of agadata, which means the story part, and it is not written in a halachic context, as is the first source. Let's look at the third source. This is a very interesting one, which we'll definitely refer back to a couple of times. The third source, where is it from? Someone called Rabbi Peretz of Korbil. He wrote a book called the Hagaot Hasmak. Hagaot Smak. Now, when did he live? He lived in the 1200s, even before the 1200s, right? And this is brought in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law as well. He lived before. Remember, the Code of Jewish Law was written in the 1500s. But he wrote the 1200s also brought. It writes like this. A woman should not lie on the bed sheets upon which another man slept, lest she become impregnated from his semen with the remote possibility that her offspring may later inadvertently marry a sibling. Okay, important to note, what is the problem? He says the problem is, no, there's no real problem. The only problem is that could be that that guy will have a child later on and they will marry each other and they won't know that they're really brother and sister. They have the same father, which is obviously forbidden from the Torah. On the other hand, he continues, a woman is not prohibited, even when she is nida, from lying on the bed sheets upon which her husband slept, because since there is no forbidden intercourse, and there is no concern of her offspring marrying a sibling, as she knows that they are all from the husband, there's no problem whatsoever. Now, what's the idea is like this, that obviously a woman who is a nida, who is menstruating, is forbidden to her husband during those days. Okay? Now, he says, but there's no problem whatsoever for the woman to lie on the bed sheets of her husband. Could be that there would be semen from the husband on the bed sheets, and she would get pregnant from that. Says there's no problem whatsoever. No problem whatsoever, whatsoever. Because, and these are the important words, he says, that since there's no forbidden intercourse, and there's also obviously no worry that there's going to be two children going to marry each other because it's only the husband, therefore, there's no problem whatsoever. Seems to imply from here. Let's examine this and see what we can learn from this. First of all, what's very clear, in 1200s, it was from the fact that he's writing a halacha. He's writing something halachic. Now, they don't make halachas. And this, the Haggadot HaSmach is a book of laws. It's not a book of theories and a book of discussion. But the fact that he writes it in the book of laws means that it was definitely something which they recognized as a halachic possibility. Okay? Far-fetched. I don't know medically how it could work, right? But far-fetched it may be, but it was recognized as a possibility. Now, from the fact that they only mention the issue, that he only mentions the issue, that siblings may inadvertently marry each other, seems to imply that as long as there was no intercourse, as long as there was no physical union, the offspring is considered 100% legitimate, right? Remember, she's married. We're talking about the first half of it. She's married. Let's say that she would go and sleep on another man's bed sheets, and she would get pregnant. He says, doesn't say that the child would be illegitimate. Doesn't say that at all, right? So she said, no way, it can't be that the child would be illegitimate. He doesn't say the child would be illegitimate. All he says is that there would be another problem. The problem is that they may come to marry each other, right? You're not going to know who's the father. You're going to think that the father is the husband. Really, the father is the guy whose sheets she was lying on. Another thing we point out over here, remember, each word is exact. He doesn't mention any prohibition whatsoever of her living with her husband were she to get pregnant from someone else without intercourse by lying on the bed sheets, right? No mention whatsoever. No mention of that. That doesn't seem to be an issue whatsoever. You see, one by one, this small text is solving a lot of our problems. We'll address them head on as well, but this we'll be referring to. From the fact, the fourth point, which we can take out of here, that we learn from here, from the fact that we are concerned that siblings may marry each other, what can we deduce? What can we take out? What we can take out is that the children born from artificial insemination, children born from that man who lay on the sheets, are in fact his children, right? Because if they wouldn't be his children, there would be no worry whatsoever of siblings marrying each other. The only problem is siblings are not allowed to marry each other either, even if they're half brothers. I mean, that's what we're talking about over here, that there would be, half siblings from the father. They're not allowed to marry each other. Why? Because they have the same father. So we can learn from this source another point. We learn from this source that the Talmud or Halacha considers it that if a child was born from that fatherhood, we'll put it this way, fatherhood is established by the one whose semen the child came from, and not by the physical unit. It doesn't have to be that way. And therefore, if she lay on those bed sheets, she got pregnant from lying on those bed sheets, it doesn't matter, the child of the one from whom the semen came, he is the father, and therefore there's the worry that they may inadvertently marry each other. We'll discuss whether, in such a way, the father fulfills the mitzvah of puruvu of having children. Right? Seemingly he would, because if they're his children, either way you look at it, if they're his children, so then he fulfills the mitzvah. If they're not his children, then he doesn't fulfill the mitzvah. Yeah?
So is that considered adultery
as well, then? He says, no, it doesn't seem to be adultery. He doesn't mention any issue of adultery.
Right.
Doesn't mention at all issue of adultery. All that he mentions is that there may be the problem, the only issue mentioned, there may be the problem down the line in 20 years' time when it comes time to get married, the two siblings may marry each other. Doesn't mention adultery, doesn't mention anything. But as we shall see, it's not so simple. It seems to be so simple, everyone accepts it, but I wish it was so simple. It's not so simple. Because there is, of course, place to argue. As mentioned, all these cases are when it came about either by mistake or not with intention, right? She went to the bathhouse. She lay on the sheets. Okay, she lay on the sheets. But still, the man from whom it came didn't do it intentionally. He didn't want to impregnate her when he lay on the sheets and some of his semen came out, right? Whereas artificial insemination, this is a way which we can argue, is perhaps a little bit more direct because there's actually an act going on over there which is not just by mistake. It doesn't just happen that she goes to the bathhouse. It doesn't just happen that she's lying on the sheets, but actually there's a doctor involved. There's a husband who knows what's going on. There's the wife. The woman definitely knows what's going on. And there, perhaps, you can argue, and we'll address this head on, we could perhaps argue over there, well, that may be adultery. That may be a little bit more direct. That may be more problematic. We'll see in the end why it's not really, because most people accept that this halachic source applies to all situations, right? But we can argue, and some rabbis do argue, that it would be a little bit different. Now, we'll directly address some of these above-mentioned issues. We'll talk about them this week and next week. We'll break them down into the categories of husband, categories, the different kinds that there are, husband, donor, and specifically over here, we'll talk about donor. We'll break down to donor who's Jewish and non-Jewish donor or unknown donor. Well, like a sperm bank. Let's first look at the artificial insemination from the semen of the husband. We'll look at those issues. Those are the more simple ones, and then we'll get on to the donor. We'll get to that next week. There were great rabbis who forbade artificial insemination from the husband for a number of reasons. I mentioned just two of their reasons. The main reason was, it could be, they said that the sperm which is emitted into the test tube, which is given for such a thing, will go to waste. They were worried that it's going to go to waste. And there's this great biblical prohibition of not wasting seed whatsoever. And they worried if it would not impregnate the wife, perhaps the seed would be going to waste. Because maybe the only instance in which the Torah allowed it is if it's done in a natural way, in the way of a physical union, in normal marital relations. That was their main concern, that the problem of what's called, that there would be a zera levatola, there would be seed going out in waste. Then there's another worry, which they were concerned about, talking about not simple rabbis who raise these concerns, usually this is a while back, and that is the worry that what will be, that the doctor may mix the husband's semen with the semen of another man in order of a donor to ensure maximum success, which is something you read about today, and it's not absolutely far-fetched. You might think that today, in today's world, it's impossible that such a thing could be done. I mean, it's nothing more disgusting than to do such a thing. But I was reading about last year where they discovered someone, a doctor of a fertility clinic in America, who was actually doing this all the time. He had a fertility clinic which was almost double as successful as the others in the area. In New Jersey, was in America. They investigated him, and they actually found that he was mixing. And that's why, obviously, the husband's had a bit of a problem, right? He wanted to make that he has huge success, and he was mixing. I don't know, he was taking from his own. I don't know what it was. But he was definitely becoming more successful in that. And this is what these rabbis were concerned about. And therefore, they said, we can't start up with this, and let it not be allowed. Most rabbinic, that is some rabbis. And I have to stress some, and the vast, vast minority it is. Most rabbis, rabbinic decisors, rule that the prohibition of emitting seed for nothing does not apply here whatsoever. And why is that? Since the purpose over here, the whole purpose is procreation, the whole purpose is to fulfill the mitzvah, to try and fulfill the mitzvah of having children, and the prohibition is only if semen is emitted wastefully, if it's wasted, but over here it's not wasted. they're trying as hard as possible to actually do the mitzvah. So as long as it's in part of the process of fulfilling the mitzvah, they say then there's no prohibition whatsoever. Some rabbis go on to say that even if we are to say that the husband does not fulfill the mitzvah of pruvu, of having children in such a way, which we'll discuss, does the husband fulfill the mitzvah? So even if we're to say that the husband does not fulfill the mitzvah of having children in such a way, unless it comes about in a natural fashion, nevertheless, the semen has still not been produced for waste, has still not been emitted wastefully, since how could you call it a waste if a child will be born from such a thing? Now, it's important to mention over here, we'll speak about it when we discuss whether the husband actually fulfills the mitzvah. There's two mitzvahs. A lot of people don't know this. There's actually two mitzvahs. The first mitzvah of the Torah is to have children. How does one have to, what is the obligation that a person should have? A son and a daughter. That's what it is. Zachar and a keva. Then there's another mitzvah of Loshevet Yitzara, to settle the earth. And it's a separate mitzvah. God said to Adam, he said, I'm giving you the earth and I want you to settle the earth. Right? So they're not necessarily put together. So even if we say that a person does not fulfill the mitzvah of pru revu, of having children in such a way, nevertheless, there is still a mitzvah being accomplished. What mitzvah? The earth is being settled with human beings. Okay? So therefore, even if we say that the mitzvah of pru revu, the mitzvah of having children, is not fulfilled in such a way, where actually the fact is that it actually is, as we'll see, nevertheless, the semen has not been emitted wastefully, since a child will hopefully be born as a result. In order, yeah.
Just one question.
Sure.
If it's found that, as we're specifically here talking about the husband being infertile, having levels of infertility, if that's the case, divorcing his wife after 10 years when he's had children, now...
That's not practiced today.
Right.
What are you going to ask?
I was going to say, but now that you can actually tell that it's the husband rather than...
Right. No, today, anyway, it's not practiced. Right. Anyway, it's not practiced. But, however, it could still be used as grounds for divorce. I wasn't going to mention this, but there's another interesting question. Another interesting question which was actually raised in the court in Tel Aviv a couple of years ago. And that is a question regarding a couple who couldn't have children, and halachically, if you really push, there is grounds for divorce in such a way. The husband says, I want to have children, I want to fulfill the mitzvah, right? Now, can the husband say that I want to divorce even though I have not tried artificial insemination, right? Whereas the wife says, hey, but let's try this. Or can the husband say, well, the Torah says, or the halacha says, the Talmud says that if I'm married for 10 years and haven't had children, the Talmud doesn't say, well, then try artificial insemination, right? I want to have it in a natural way. I don't want to have it in such a way. Is it grounds for divorce or not? It was a major discussion which was brought up. I only remembered it because you mentioned that point. Now, we said that there was another issue. So the vast majority, and that's what's accepted today, is that there's no problem from the husband point of view of emitting seed in wastefully. It's not considered to be waste. In order to avoid the issue of possible mixing of the semen, which was the other concern, it is necessary, they're right, that it can still, we're not going to prevent couples from having children. These are what the rabbis who argue, they say, that who allow it. So we're not going to prevent couples from having children just because we're worried about one meshugana, one doctor, who's not going to act nicely, who's not going to do things, who's not going to be upright, not going to do things the right way. Therefore, they say, what you should do, obviously, you have to use a God-fearing doctor, or a doctor who's trustworthy, who will be together with another doctor, to be able to check on him. And the best way, obviously, is to have a supervisor, someone who... a rabbinic supervisor, someone who will be able to be there and be able to know that there was no mixing going on whatsoever, which today is very, very common. I'm not talking about the mixing, I'm talking about getting a rabbinic supervisor. It's something which is just like you have a mashgiach for kashrut. There are mashgichim for almost any IVF or these clinics in most cities where there are Jews in the world, because it's something which Jews need just like anyone else, and there is hashgacha for it. Now, even those rabbis who are the majority that allow the artificial insemination of the husband, as we said, they only allow it in a case of great need, because again, there's this prohibition, right? What does it mean, great need? Some rabbis require that the couple be trying to have children for 5 years. Other rabbis say 2 years is already enough. And most rabbis agree that it depends, or on the individual case. If the doctors, together with a rabbi who assesses the situation, are able to diagnose that this couple naturally cannot have children, but with artificial insemination, they stand a very good chance of having children, so then the halacha says, then you can try it out, right? But just to go on day one without anything, there's no rabbis who allow that. On day one to just try it because, well, for whatever reason, we don't want to have children naturally, that rabbis don't allow. But most today rule that it's absolutely allowed, provided that there is a medical diagnosis that this is the way that it will work for this particular couple.
So what about the single women?
Sorry? That's a lot more problematic. That's definitely problematic. Well, I'll mention some words of some halakhic decisors, what they say about such a thing. They say mainly not everything is, remember, I mentioned this before, sometimes there are things which in Shulchan Aruch, in the code of Jewish law, may be allowed, strictly may be allowed. But nevertheless, the Talmud would say, Ein ruach chachamim nochemenu, which means the rabbis don't find it favorable. They don't like it, right? For example, I'll give you the classic example is, which we always told this in yeshiva when discussing this topic, the rabbis would always say, you know that if you look in the code of Jewish law, you won't find that it's a problem. You won't find anywhere where it says that you cannot wear your arm tefillin when you go to the bathroom. You know that? Your head tefillin you cannot wear when you go to the bathroom. That says clear. But it doesn't say anywhere that you can't wear your arm tefillin, put it in your jacket, cover up, and go into the bathroom. It doesn't say that. Nevertheless, which rabbi is going to find it to be a nice thing to take the arm tefillin, which has the name of God inside, and walk into the bathroom? The same thing. There's a lot of things which, even though halachically it may be allowed, it may be fine, the rabbis say, this is disgusting. This is not the way of doing things, right? They say that regarding a single woman who just wants to have children, because the point is that it destroys, the way they write, it destroys the whole family life. Destroys that whole the whole setup which the Torah is about. So too they say the same words about what we mentioned in the beginning, a husband who is the man has died and the wife wants to have children from him. They say halachically may be okay, right? To take his semen out of him before burial and impregnating his wife. So halachically may be okay, right? But I'll quote the end, I don't have the words with me right now, but they say that, I quote the words, he says, this is the most repulsive, despicable, and indecent act, apart from the halachic ramifications. So it's disgusting, it's not something, you give the child that's going to grow up without a father, I mean, it's something which is, they write apart from the halachic ramifications, right, which he doesn't go on to mention, which there are when it comes to levirate marriage and things like that. There is much rabbinic discussion as to the best ways to produce the semen. Which is the best way? The best way, obviously, would be that the couple have normal marital relations, and then the semen just be taken out of the woman and put into her properly, right? But obviously, medically, that doesn't, most times, it doesn't work, and people wouldn't even be advised to do so. Therefore, most rabbinic decisors, most poskim actually allow in this particular situation for the husband to use a condom. And this is one of the very, very rare situations, only for this purpose. To use a condom to be used for the purpose of obtaining semen to put into his wife. Why is it not wasteful? It's not wasteful at all, because it's part of the process of having children. There are, of course, it's a major discussion. There are, of course, those who actually write that, you know, the better thing to do, well, to use the condom, but to make some kind of hole in it. Because if you make some kind of hole, it means that natural conception is possible, right? Whereas if you block it out, then it means that there's no possibility whatsoever. Right? But anyway, in this particular situation, would be allowed. Now, is the child born of artificial insemination from the husband considered to be the child of the husband in all matters or not? Now, the answer to this would also seemingly answer whether the father has fulfilled the mitzvah of pruvu, the mitzvah of having children, or not. Now, we find that this direct issue of whether the child, we'll finish in a couple of minutes, of whether the child goes back to the father, whether the child belongs to the father, this direct issue is mentioned by the commentaries of Shulchan Aruch. The commentaries of the Code of Jewish Law in 1500s already raised the question. They said, does a child who's born from the bathhouse baby, does this child, is he or she the son or daughter of the father of the person whose semen it came from? And they write that since we find that Ben Sira, who was brought in the Medrash, this Ben Sira was considered to be the son of Yirmiyahu, and we know this, that he was considered to be the son of Yirmiyahu, from the fact that he wasn't even ashamed, he wanted to change his name, but he wasn't ashamed that his name should be the Gematria, the numerical value of Yirmiyahu. Sira in Gematria Yirmiyahu means that he considered himself, and therefore halakhically would have been considered, the son of his father, the son of the person whose semen he came from, which was Yirmiyahu. Others prove it from the third text, this text from the Haggadah Tasmak, where we see that there is the concern, we mentioned this before, there is the concern, the only concern, is that the siblings may marry each other. So the woman, again, the woman lay on sheets of another man, right? There's a problem. She's not allowed to. Why is she not allowed to? The only reason says, no, it's not adultery, because there was no union. There's no physical union over there. The problem is that the child who is born may marry the sibling 20 years down the line. What do you see from that? From the fact that we're concerned, that halacha is concerned, that they're going to marry the siblings, that a sibling might marry the other, means that they're actually siblings. It means that they're related. It means that the father, the one whose semen produced the child, is considered to be the father of that child. So that is a very strong halachic source for the fact that a father, that a artificial insemination from the donor or from the husband, that person, doesn't matter that there wasn't any physical union over there to produce the child, nevertheless, that child is considered 100% to be the child of the person whose semen comes from. How? Somehow it was, right? You're not allowed to, but how was in the bathhouse, how was in many of these cases, right? No, we obviously, that's what we will point out. There's a difference between these cases where it happened, like I said. These cases we may be able to excuse saying that they were passive, right? Wasn't someone actively went and tried to go and do it? Whereas what we're talking about over here is when it's actually an active point. We'll begin with that next week. There are, however, there is a minority view, but this will conclude here. There's a minority view who wrote, of rabbis, who, I say wrote, because there's no one to hold of this now, that a child born in such a way, from artificial insemination, is, well, you may say that it's allowed, whatever reason, but not in fact. The father has not fulfilled the mitzvah of pruvu. The father has not fulfilled the mitzvah of procreation, which we'll discuss. We'll start with that next week. And also, the child does not belong to the father whatsoever. They say, but it said over here in the third source. Well, first of all, they'll say the second source is just a medrash. Okay, it's not halachic. The third source, which we said that maybe the siblings will marry each other. That could just be not that they're actually related to each other. It could be that the rabbis are concerned of what it may look like. They're concerned of the meaning that the rabbis placed that restriction, but not that biblically there would be a restriction. That's what could be. So again, there's the main accepted view: the children from artificial insemination are the husband, the donor's children, 100%, which will cause us a lot of problems, by the way, for the donor, as we'll see. Now we're talking about the husband. The husband is good; belongs to the husband, 100%. There's that very minority view that the children are not children of the husband whatsoever, because only children that come about through a normal, natural, physical union are children. The children are to be considered children of the husband, there are yet others who take a bit of a middle line. And they say that even though that the child is completely considered the father's child, 100%, the child that came about through artificial insemination, nevertheless, the father has not fulfilled the mitzvah of having children, of pru'uvu, because the mitzvah, the way the Torah requires it to be done, is that the way it was done by Adam and Eve. And the Torah describes the way it was done by Adam and Eve was not by artificial insemination. It was, it says, that they knew each other, there was a physical union over there. So that's the middle line. But the majority accepted opinion today is that children, and these are based on these two sources, from the Medrash and on this source from the Haggadah Tasmach, which is a source which could be read very superficially, but there's a lot of depth to the source. It teaches us a lot of things. Not so much from what it says, but from what it doesn't say. Doesn't say that there's adultery. Doesn't say that the husband is forbidden to, that the wife is forbidden to her husband. Doesn't say a whole lot of things. That teaches us a lot that the child, one of the things we're learning about over here, that the child belongs to the father 100%. So please God, next week we'll continue this discussion. We'll finish off the discussion to do with the husband. We'll talk about, has he fulfilled the mitzvah of procreation? The interesting discussion of what about his husband who has, well, we said you're not allowed to emit seed wastefully for nothing, right? So we said that if it's in the process of having children, of fulfilling the mitzvah of having children, so then it's not for waste. Well, what if a couple already has 10 children and they want to have more children now, but they can only have these more children by, for whatever reason, by artificial insemination? Are they then allowed to continue to have children in such a way? It's an interesting one. There's no mitzvah. Or maybe there is the mitzvah of settling the earth, right? We'll talk about that. Then when it comes to the donor, of course, there's these fascinating issues, a lot of them of adultery, all the issues that we raised in the beginning. Adultery, is the child illegitimate? Is it allowed in the first place, the donor? Is there a difference between if the donor is Jewish, non-Jewish? We'll talk all about that. Any questions?